Committee to order, and we're going to go into the public hearing first, and we'll come back and do the work session on Senate Bill 435. So the first bill we will hear is Senate Bill 630. Marjorie?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 630 requires the Board of Pharmacy to establish and maintain a database to electronically monitor dispensing of certain controlled substances. It restricts access to and limits the use of that information in the database and limits the use of the registration number for prescribers and dispensers of controlled substances.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, by the way, in your packet, you have a Dash 1 amendment that Tom Holt will explain, and you also have a letter from Cindy Laubacher of Medco Health, and also a letter from Ann Walsh, the Executive Director of the Board of Naturopathic Examiners.
Okay. Gary Schnabel and Tom Holt, would you please come forward? Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Schnabel. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I'm here today to speak in support of the bill and offer the Board of Pharmacy's support for Senate Bill 630. I have a handout that you should receive in a minute if you haven't got it. It's just an outline of what I will be talking about. My plan would be to simply fairly briefly go through the bill and what the bill does and why we want the bill and a little bit of background, and then I'll just be ready to answer any questions that might come up. Section 2 of the bill establishes a controlled substance prescription monitoring program, just establishes the program, and it identifies who will administer the program. Section 3 of the bill identifies what information will be kept in a central database and by the Board of Pharmacy, administered by the Board of Pharmacy, and identifies who needs to report information into that database. That the information that will be included in that database will simply be some data elements from the pharmacy's existing controlled substance dispensing records. So people are not having to develop some information system that's not already in place. They keep that data already, so they would simply have parts of that provided to and maintained in a central database for controlled substances. Section 4 identifies who has access to the information and for what purpose. That's one of the and identifies safeguards to protect the prescribers and dispensers and the information. It identifies that only prescribers or pharmacists involved in the care of that patient can have access to the information for purposes related to patient care. And it identifies an investigator for the purposes of a specific investigation to have access to that. And that's only on a specific individual for a specific investigation. So someone couldn't call up and say, give me a list of all your doctors who are prescribing OxyContin or anything else. We would say, we can't give you that. That information is in the database, and we could generate a report, but we'd be way busted. I mean, that's a violation of the bill that way, to provide that kind of a report. And the other thing that the bill does, that's one thing, is it creates the database and the safeguards around the database. It also would limit the use of a practitioner's DEA number for uses only related to controlled substances. And the brief background on that is that the DEA number was a control number issued to practitioners who dispense, only to practitioners who dispense controlled substances and only for that purpose. And over the years that third parties and insurances have come to use that number for identifying that physician for reimbursement purposes and for drugs that are not controlled substances. So this would put the use of that DEA number back into the issues of controlled substances where it was designed. It wasn't designed to be an identification number, but a control number for prescribers of controlled substances. Just a brief background, and I might take a minute to describe for you the difference between a controlled substance, or the distinction between a controlled substance and a prescription drug. Often those terms are used synonymously and can confuse the issue. All controlled substances are not prescription drugs, and all prescription drugs are not controlled substances. And it's maybe not as confusing as that might make it sound, and I'll try to give you an example with names that you recognize so you'll know. A controlled substance is not a prescription drug. It would be marijuana or heroin or cocaine that you buy on the street. Those are controlled substances, but they're not prescribed by a physician and people can't get a hold of it. A controlled substance that is a prescription drug, examples would be Percodan or Vicodin or morphine or Demerol, names that you probably recognize. These are controlled substances and are commonly used and prescribed by physicians and dispensed through pharmacies to people to use at home or while they're in the hospital. A prescription drug that's not a controlled substance would be any drug that is not narcotic with extra controls by the DEA, but still requires a prescription to be dispensed or to be accessed by the patient. So the term controlled substance refers to the additional controls on that prescription drug placed there by the DEA. And that's done because of the risk of misuse of those drugs. Those are the drugs that get diverted to the street for a variety of reasons. The purpose and the main focus of this bill is to identify and break the cycle of the patient who gets labeled with words like drug seeker and doctor shopper. They're displaying, in the jargon that we use, drug-seeking behaviors. For a variety of reasons, they're scamming somehow by altering or forging a prescription or calling up, pretending to be a doctor and ordering a prescription for themselves, or going to multiple pharmacies or seeing multiple doctors without telling one doctor they're seeing another. So they're getting more drugs than they're supposed to get. And this happens for various reasons. Sometimes it's somebody who is addicted, criminal type, or sometimes it's actually a patient with legitimate pain symptoms and is not getting adequate treatment for the symptoms and is finding one way or another to get that. This program will identify those people and break the cycle that they're in, plug them back in to their practitioner who can make decisions about how to proceed with the care of that patient, whether they need more drugs for pain or whether they need less drugs to feed an addiction or what. It goes back to the practitioner to make those kind of decisions. And just as an illustration of that, I want to read you one sentence from an article from the Portland Tribune from earlier this month. This is March 11th, so it's 2 weeks old. The headline is, "Drug Deals Persist a Year After Xanax Shooting." Xanax is a controlled substance. The byline is, "In the past, Robert Eric Hines has watched all of his immediate family members die in separate incidents of drug overdose or illnesses exacerbated by poverty and homelessness. The sentence from the second page of this article is this. According to court documents and interviews, Hines made his living in Portland by illegally obtaining prescriptions for drugs such as Xanax from various doctors and selling the pills in Pioneer Courthouse Square area. That was an article from just 2 weeks ago, and I don't think that it's a coincidence. I think articles like this appear periodically, and I think the incident and incidents like that occur a lot more than we would like to, I think, be aware of. So again, this bill is aimed at those cycles so that we can get people diverted before they die or before they become addicted because their pain isn't being treated properly. On the back of the outline that I gave you, I think the most important point that I want to make is that in doing what we're doing with this bill, we don't interfere with appropriate prescribing, and that's the concern that has been expressed. Above all, we don't want to discourage physicians from prescribing the drugs that they think their patient needs, and we don't want to cause the chilling effect that is the fear that's raised and legitimately raised by practitioners who deal with people in pain. In terms of the costs and the logistics to the medical practitioner or the prescriber of the drug, this is transparent. They do nothing different than they do now. There's no special or particular prescription form. There's nothing different, no record keeping different from what they already do. They would forget that it's in place. The pharmacist will have to do a periodic mouse click monthly or weekly or whatever the cycle is determined to be by rule. And to the state agency, that's where the cost will be. There's a cost for the database, which could be a contract with a company that developed and working with a number of the 18 states that already have programs. Or it can be an in-house database like some states use. And the difference is, the result is the same. The difference is that if you have an in-house database, you pay your own staff to do the work. If you contract with Atlantic Associates, you have less of a staff requirement, but you pay Atlantic to do the work. And what they do is simply collect the data electronically and collate it and then forward it into the computer. The hardware requirement for the agency is simply a standalone computer so that the information is isolated from the regular office network computers so that nobody has access to that except the administrator of the program. And then there will be a requirement for high-speed fax and printers to get the reports back and forth. In Nevada, the program receives about 50 requests per day from practitioners for specific information for a specific patient. In Kentucky, which is a more aggressive program that spends $400,000 to $500,000 a year, they get in excess of 400 requests a day from Kentucky physicians. So the people who use this program are really using the information and making it work. The issue of funding and where the money is going to come from for the program, there are a variety of possibilities. The bill as it stands now provides a dollar from general funds to open up an account and would have the board then seek startup grants from federal government or from corporate. And there are some of those available that were qualified to apply for. With that, I guess I'll finish and be here for questions.
Okay. Tom, you want to go ahead and then we can ask questions?
Sure. For the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Our members are the individual practitioners of pharmacy in various practice settings around the state. What I'd like to do briefly is, one, talk about why we support the program in general and then specifically about the Dash 1 Amendment. What this proposal would do is resolve a problem that has really forced practitioners to deal ad hoc with people who are engaging in what we call drug-seeking behaviors. What has developed now, because practitioners are concerned about people seeking drugs that they should not have, is in some local areas, there are fax lists that make their way around amongst pharmacies and emergency rooms and other places where people present. And sometimes people are unfairly on those lists, and there is no formal feedback to the originating practitioners in that kind of an ad hoc system necessarily. So by creating a database where a practitioner who has a question about someone who's seeking a medication could go to that and see instantly whether or not there's a question to be raised would be of great value. And the fact that it would be a relatively low cost is also very attractive. From a pharmacy standpoint, administering is almost literally nothing more than a mouse click. Our understanding is that in other states that have these programs, the necessary software is a free download to the pharmacy to make use of. And so from an administrative standpoint, the effort required is very low. But I would underscore what Gary said in terms of the seriousness of the problem. This is one of the key reasons why in the Medicaid program we have what we call a pharmacy lock-in, where people have to select a primary pharmacy and use only that pharmacy. One of the biggest reasons for that, there were some other reasons, but the primary reason was to eliminate some drug-seeking behavior. And at the same time, as others, we do not want to get in the way of appropriate use of controlled substance prescriptions. Pain management's a serious issue, and patients who need medication for that should be able to get it. Now, the Dash 1 amendments address a provision having to do with the DEA numbers in the bill. And as written, what the bill does is sunset the use of the Drug Enforcement Administration number on the effective date of the bill. What we have suggested here is to delay that till January 1, 2005, and then specifically have requiring the use of a number developed by the National Council on Prescription Drug Programs. Now, that requires a little bit of explanation of who NCPDP is and what their role is in all this. They are a standard-setting organization for all pharmacy claims transmission. They set the parameters through which pharmacies communicate with third-party payers online and resolve claims issues, and the money issues all get resolved and adjudicated. NCPDP already is specifically designated in the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act as the standard setter for pharmacy claims under HIPAA. And they are currently having discussions with the federal government, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, about the HIPAA number. All expectation at this point is that a new provider number that has been developed by NCPDP will be the HIPAA approved number. That is currently being built. What NCPDP folks have told me is that they will, for any third-party payer, receive their database provider prescribers at no cost, upgrade or update that to include or convert all those to NCPDP numbers. They expect that work will be done toward the end of this year. And so that's why we looked at 2005. That's two more cycles, essentially, of the normal healthcare contracts. So we would suggest this amendment to the bill just to make the transition a little bit less burdensome on payers. Now, I have had conversations with Cindy Laubacher or Medco about their suggested amendment, and they object to our amendment. I think we need to have some more conversations around where NCPDP is in their process. I think there's some misunderstanding about NCPDP's role, but let me be clear about the suggested amendment from Merck Medco is to say that the way that it's written, it would for the first time put in statute an allowance to use the DEA number. And that is nowhere in Oregon law at this point. It is something that's developed over time, and what we and others would like to end and sunset the use of the Drug Enforcement Administration numbers. There's a lot of sensitivity to the use of those numbers in the prescribing process. They're necessary for controlled substance prescriptions, but when a physician prescribes something that is not a controlled substance and the pharmacy still has to ask for that number, physicians often object, and for good reason, because they believe that the number should only be used for its intended purposes, and we agree with them on that. And unfortunately, the claim system doesn't let us restrict it to that at this point. So that's an important provision of the bill, and we would hope to be able to work that out before this is brought back.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Senator Minnis.
I've got a series of questions. I'm not exactly sure where to start, but I want to ask staff if this is a technical defect or if I'm not understanding it. If you read on page 2 of the bill, under the civil liability section, subsection 5, section 4, it says that persons are immune from civil liability for providing information as authorized under Section 3 above, which I understand. And then sub B of that says obtaining, using, or relying on information from the electronic prescription monitoring database as authorized by Section 5. If I read Section 5, Section 5 has to do with grants, acceptance of grants. It seems not to make any sense.
Okay.
I think we're talking about Section 1 of, or subsection 1 of Section 4, I think.
You can address that.
And then that led me to one of my other questions, which was what is the consequence for the abuse of the use of this information? I know we have civil immunity for people who would do so as authorized, but what if they do so not authorized to do it? What happens to them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, my understanding is that the only authority would be what authority the Board of Pharmacy already has for disciplinary action to licensees or civil penalty to anyone violating the Pharmacy Practice Act, and this language would become part of the Pharmacy Practice Act. The authority the Board has for someone who's not a pharmacist is limited to maximum of $1,000 civil penalty for violation of the act.
Okay.
If it is a pharmacist, then they have a range of a disciplinary action regarding the pharmacist's license, from reprimand to civil penalty to revocation.
All right. And Mr. Chairman, in Section 4, Subsection 2, Subsection E, where it authorizes a federal, state, or local law enforcement officer who's engaged in an authorized investigation involving the person to whom the request information pertains to have access to the information, would that be obtained via a warrant or via subpoena, or would it be allowed just based upon a law enforcement officer identifying themselves? And
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think the threshold for authority hasn't really been identified yet. Other states do it in various ways, but it somehow has to be determined by staff administering the program that the practitioner or the pharmacist or the law enforcement officer is duly engaged in their activity under that section. In other words, however they do it, it is really an authorized law enforcement officer with an authorized investigation.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, I'm just asking the question for clarification, because oftentimes in my work, if I want to get records from a medical facility or hospital, they usually like to have a subpoena of some sort. Generally, and I'm assuming that's the way we would normally do it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, it would be a normal process. It's not addressed in the bill, and it would probably be better addressed in the regulations that are written. And we would, we would take advice from law enforcement about how they identify themselves and what's reasonable identification.
All right, now, Mr. Chairman, one other question. In subsection 2 of section 4, sub B, it authorizes the release of the information to an attorney or, and this is where I get a little confused, other person representing the person. to whom the information pertains. Is that my mother, or who would that be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, most of this language is taken from the best parts of statutes in other states authorizing this program and are authorizing programs like this. And I don't know that that was intended to mean any particular person. Attorneys represent individuals, a family member or somebody else, or an executor or somebody might represent an individual. And I think that was only to authorize somebody who legitimately represented that person, even though they might not be an attorney.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming that this would be somebody, a guardian or a conservator or someone of that status. But it doesn't say that. So.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, yeah, that's the intent.
Should it say that?
Well, I think it should, because, I mean, frankly, with the loosey-goosey language here, it just simply says that it can be provided to another person representing the person. Well, that could be your real estate agent. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we in various places we use the term patient's agent as somebody who's authorized to represent the patient, you know, however they get to that point. I guess the other issue is if we didn't even have that piece there, I think that under Section 4, Subsection 1B, subject to the provisions of ORS 192.410 to 192.505, might cover that scenario anyway. That relates to the distribution of, I'm sorry, the public records, disclosure of public records.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I understand that. I'm not really comfortable with that. I think we ought to have some folks take a look at this in terms of guardianship issues and such, because there may be a guardian who may want access to the records that would have a lawful authority to do so, who's not an attorney but has legal authority to represent the client themselves. So.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you. Scott Gallant, Barney Spate. Barney, yeah, you're both here. Would you come up, please? Scott, do you want to start? Barney is always the cleanup hitter, and he usually has good news. So far, two out of three.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. We have 6,800 physician members of the Medical Association. This legislation, I think, does require some very serious consideration of what its implications are and how it would, in fact, operate in a practical way, and what kind of impact it may have on physicians and patients, for that matter, in your consideration of the bill. To us, the first issue is to what degree is the illicit diversion of prescriptive medications occurring in the state of Oregon, and are there currently mechanisms that physicians and other health care providers are in fact required to participate in order to deal with that issue? My response to that is, one, there are in fact requirements both under the Medicaid program, Drug Utilization Review Committee or Advisory Board, the Board of Medical Examiners, licenses, obviously, and disciplines, and registers physicians who dispense medications, and our physicians are, in fact, required currently to keep a record, a log, of medications that are dispensed. Schedule II drugs are typically the drugs that are of most concern, and that information is, in fact, shared with the Drug Enforcement Agency, who is responsible under the Controlled Substances Act for the illicit use of medications, in this case, prescriptive medications. The bill, as it is drafted, well, let me go back a step. There was an example given in the previous testimony about a particular medication out of a newspaper. One medication, for example, OxyContin is a pain medication that has, it's a time-release medication, and unfortunately, in some parts of the country, has been diverted and used by individuals and has been found to be very addictive if misused, and has caused some tremendous devastation in areas like Kentucky and West Virginia and other parts of the U.S. In reviewing comments from the director of the DEA in a speech regarding this particular medication, he has alluded to OxyContin as a particular problem. And in reviewing the states that have this particular program, Oregon is ranked 22nd in the prescribing of OxyContin, below five states that have this particular problem in place. One state, just in 2000, I believe it's New Mexico, in fact closed down or dropped their electronic monitoring program. So my point is that there should be some serious consideration of whether or not under the current structure of how Schedule II drugs are reviewed and reported to the DEA, of whether we have a major problem in being able to track drug seekers or diversion of prescriptive medications. I don't know if the proponents provided the committee with that information, but I think it would be useful. If you also look at the terms and language of the bill itself, essentially what it says is that the Board of Pharmacy will use some unnamed criteria for determining whether or not there is a need for an investigation for the prevention or avoidance of inappropriate use that is not defined in the terms of the bill of what inappropriate use means and who makes that determination and on what basis, or whether an investigation is initiated at the board's own authority where they may suspect someone, that could be a physician or a patient, for violating state or federal laws regarding controlled substances. Again, the bill does not provide any guidance on what standards those would be. And the reason it is somewhat sensitive is if you look at what may be released because of a suspicion under the terms of this act, the names of patients and physicians may be released to third parties. And because the bill also provides liability protection for the distribution of this information, it would appear that if there was an unfortunate accusation where a physician or, let's say, a patient's name became publicly accused of inappropriate use or diversion of prescriptive medications, you could ruin their reputation with no recourse in the process.
Now, Scott, may I interrupt?
You may, most certainly may, Mr. Chairman.
Would you have a problem, or are you getting out if they release the information to the appropriate law enforcement agency to look into? Would that provide the confidentiality that you're concerned about? if they worked with the law enforcement. Now, that's something that may have to be fixed in this bill, but if it gave direction concerning the release of information. Because I see this as the first line of defense, maybe, the pharmacists who have a suspicion that they're, you know, they draw it up in the on the internet and they find multiple entries, and then there it seems to me they would contact the proper, you know, the proper authorities. Is that,
Mr. Chairman, the first, to me, the first issue you need to consider is, are there current mechanisms that pick up these instances currently? That's the first issue. Again, I don't know if you've been provided that information by proponents of the bill, okay, but I think it's a legitimate thing that you need to inquire about. The second issue is, what is the basis for the initiation of an investigation? Is it mere volume of prescriptions? Is it a volume of prescriptions in a particular area? Let's say you have a physician who does treat a lot of patients for pain management. Does that trigger it? Is it triggered by individual pharmacists? Is it triggered by the board? Is there an opportunity for the practitioner or the patient whose name is released and personal information is released to have some opportunity of inquiry during that process? I don't know if that's appropriate or not if you're initiating an investigation, but I would think at some point one would want to do that. I mean, there are areas here that I think raise very serious questions that the bill doesn't address, and merely suggesting that the development of some regulations doesn't really provide the committee very much guidance in the breadth of the bill itself.
Okay.
The other issue is, if I may continue,
yes,
is this bill, in essence, creates kind of dual licensure regulatory jurisdiction that the bill does not address. The Board of Medical Examiners is the regulatory body for at least physicians. This bill would affect other practitioners. And it does not seem to address how or if, it doesn't appear to in fact require, any coordinated participation of the actual licensing entity of physicians and the Board of Pharmacy, and what actions they might take under the provisions of this act, which I think, again, the committee certainly needs to consider and try to resolve in that process. The bill also alludes to a $1 general fund appropriation, which was mentioned by previous testimony. And other states have, in fact, received grant money for startup costs. Kentucky is one that was mentioned. Mm-hmm. There are ongoing costs in Kentucky, which is a relatively similar size state as Oregon in population, is about $500,000. It's my understanding from, again, some testimony that I read from the DEA that that Kentucky is going to seek an additional $1 million to support their program. So there are certainly going to be, at some point, some fiscal impact on that process that I think legitimately the committee should consider, because it is not, I've really run into things that are free, or at least no one's offered me anything for free recently. So I guess to kind of finish my comments, I really think there does need to be some serious consideration before the committee and the legislature adopts a program that is not particularly well defined and that hasn't really been, in our opinion, worked through, and how it interrelates to a variety of different players before it might be considered or adopted by the legislature.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate the comments, Scott, and I think you've touched on some things that need to be looked at. I tend to feel that there are existing ORS that might define the parameters of reporting and confidentiality and other things that may be cited as the answer to some of your questions. There's one ORS that was referred to defining information like how something is dispersed. So the ongoing cost, that caught my attention, and my suggestion would be to raise the fees for pharmacists to cover the cost. How's that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't represent pharmacies or pharmacists, so I probably would not be appropriate.
They could always share it with the doctors. How's that?
But Mr. Chairman, in response to your mentioning other statutes, you really have to really deal with terms of the language of the proposed bill itself. And the proposed bill provides very broad discretionary authority to disclose what most people would consider to be very confidential, sensitive information, on a basis that I have heard of, mm-hmm. has not been shown to be necessary in addition to the mechanisms that currently exist.
Okay. Now, have you had an opportunity to share your concerns with the proponents of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, my boss has had conversations with Mr. Snobel, mm-hmm. On the bill, and had, in fact, discussed a couple of amendments, and in our process of having our legislative committee review the bill and council's review of the bill, we have additional concerns, most of which I have just mentioned.
Okay. Well, I would hope that you would continue your conversation.
I'm always happy to talk, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Barney.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. I'll be brief. I have two general policy issues to raise regarding this bill, and then one which is an issue of direct self-interest relative to my employer. The two general policy issues, and I know it's been touched, one of them has been touched upon earlier, that is the whole issue of the of HIPAA. There are at least three, maybe four bills that are moving through the this session of the legislature to conform Oregon law with the with the federal HIPAA Act, which goes into effect relative to patient confidentiality and privacy the middle of next month. We have concerns primarily because I think we do not understand exactly what the provisions of this bill, how they square with both federal HIPAA and what we hope would be the conforming Oregon law when those bills complete their course through the legislature. I think that's a significant issue because most health organizations, including pharmacies, hospitals, physicians' offices, third-party payers, have spent millions of dollars to try to come into compliance with HIPAA, and we're all in an area of somewhat unknown. The second is perhaps a little more fuzzy, but it comes to mind in listening to my colleague Mr. Gallant talk, and that has there's at least one bill, and I know this legislature and previous legislatures have spent a lot of time trying to rationalize the statutes that govern pain management to make sure that pain management is available and accessible, and that providers who are involved deeply in pain management feel that they can do so without a lot of fear of regulatory oversight for a regulatory damage, if you will, from in some cases some would consider to be overactive licensing boards. I think at least at some point this bill needs to be looked at in the context of both what has already transpired on pain management and what may be contemplated in pain management to make sure that the policy directions are in balance. I'm not saying that they're out of balance. I simply don't know. And I think particularly from a medical treatment point of view, that would be a concern. The last point, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is one of which I would characterize as total self-interest. Kaiser Permanente is an integrated medical system. Our pharmacy operations and our medical operations are integrated. We have an integrated automated medical record. Therefore, all of the pharmacists who deal with Kaiser Permanente members and all of the physicians and other caregivers at any of our 25-plus offices see the medical record of that member and are aware of what's going on both in the medical treatment and the prescribing, both that which has been prescribed and that which has been dispensed. We're concerned about what the cost of compliance is. I've talked with some of my colleagues that are in other models about, are they concerned about the cost of compliance? It may be something that's totally unique to Kaiser Permanente, but the feedback I get from our pharmacy administration people is a concern that because they don't yet fully understand what this technology linkage means to our system, the cost of compliance could be, from our perspective, substantial, and the public and private benefit of our participation may in fact be minimal, since we have the tools already in place for our pharmacists and our physicians and other caregivers, if you will, to oversee and review suspected either prescribing patterns or physician abuse issues. I would look forward to work with others and with the Board of Pharmacy to work through these issues on this bill, but I wanted to bring those three points to the committee's attention.
Now, thank you, Barney. Your system is a closed system, right?
It is
in the sense that you have
our providers, both our medical providers and our pharmaceutical providers work exclusively on behalf of our members.
Okay, so you have access to this type of information.
We have it in our database, and so it would be a different. The connectivity of our database to this proposed database might be a different kind of undertaking than it would be, for example, a community commercial pharmacy, which I'm told they're already collecting all this information. We are too. We may have it configured differently because we don't deal with pharmacy benefit management companies and third-party payers on a routine basis.
Is it unreasonable to assume that your patients would not go outside of your system to go to other doctors and other pharmacists for prescriptions? I mean, they're insured by through your system.
Mr. Chairman, I can get the data on that. They do on occasion, particularly when they're out of the service area or there's urgent care, but primarily our pharmaceutical benefit is one that reimburses or arranges for the payment of or provides pharmaceuticals that are dispensed through our system. I can find out how much the out-of-system use is. And I'm not trying to indicate that the goal here, both by the Board of Pharmacy and the pharmacist profession and all of us in healthcare, is not a laudable goal. I just think this bill arises at a time where both the issues of privacy, the issues of pain management, and I think the issues of cost are kind of all top of mind.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Did you have a question? No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Senator Fisher.
Barney.
Okay, I forgot about the.
Is this something that eventually HIPAA is going to require anyway?
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I'm not. I guess off as a layperson who's not doesn't consider myself, nor do I ever want to become a specialist on HIPAA. My guess is the answer. My guess would be, I don't believe HIPAA would ever require this kind of transmission of information. But what I think HIPAA does reach to is what are the standards of privacy and the security standards around the transmission of this kind of information. And clearly, there's a different standard when it's with regulatory and governmental agencies because there is an appropriate role for that. But there's a lot of concern now about all of us who move. Patient clinical information and business information between physicians' offices and hospitals and third-party payers, we're getting used to a whole new world now of potential legal liability, and that's why I think it's kind of a top-of-mind issue for all of us in the healthcare sector. including, I think, the nursing home sector.
Now, Barney, I'm glad you don't want to become a hippopotamus.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Was that a question? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Kathy Hahn, would you come up, please? Now, we've got one work session that we're going to go into as soon as Senator Dukes comes in, hopefully, and then we're going to do some hearings on three other bills. We're not going to go. We're going to end the public hearing as soon as you're through with your testimony. And I know Gary Schnabel wanted to reply, but you're going to have to work this out and then come back to us with a solution.
Kathy. Senator Morissette, members of the commission, or the committee, sorry. My name is Kathy Hahn. I'm a doctor of pharmacy at Bi-Mart in Springfield. I'm also chair of the Pain Commission for the state of Oregon. We had a presentation by Gary Schnabel. Very quickly, I'll say this. A presentation by Gary Schnabel at our last commission meeting. And this bill was unanimously approved by all members of the Pain Commission. Now, if you recall, our Pain Commission looks at all barriers in the state. We are very concerned about inadequate treatment of pain management in the state of Oregon, and our doctors looked at this unanimously as a tool that they can use to eliminate diversion and promote proper pain management in the state of Oregon. And I think you should find that this is very interesting information because my docs are the ones that would be scrutinized most. We're the ones that take care of chronic pain patients and write the most opioids. I guess I'll leave it at that. Do you have any questions?
Well, I appreciate your comments because my immediate reaction to this bill was kind of an extension of the hearings that we had on the concerns about prescribing pain medications for fear of causing addictions and so on, and this seemed to be part of the solution to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I am hearing some testimony concerning tightening it up and covering some areas that deal with confidentiality, at least to look at them. So I know there is going to be another amendment anyway. So, but I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
I want to make my comments for the record.
Your comments.
I think this bill, Senate Bill 630, is in desperate shape. In terms of just legal issues, I think Barney Spate raises some very important issues with respect to HIPAA. Those bills dealing with medical privacy issues are in my Judiciary Committee. I know the House spent weeks discussing them, and they're still a little bit confused about what they actually mean and how it applies. I'm actually surprised that the American Civil Liberties Union isn't in the audience testifying on the issues related to access by law enforcement, because they do regularly testify in the Judiciary Committee, where federal law enforcement agencies have access to state records that become part of FBI files and such and so forth. I'm afraid if they do find this out, they're going to be out here opposing the legislation for those reasons. But I just think that the missing element in this, I think I understand what its purpose is, but I'm not sure that I understand what its purpose is. I mean, it's here, it's kind of a function, it's a mechanism, but I don't understand. I agree with Scott Gallant from OMA. I'm confused about the existing process, existing system, and how those things interrelate. So before I would be willing to move forward on the bill, there's going to have to be a lot more work done on it.
Okay. Other comments? Okay. Thank you. Okay, we close the public hearing on Senate Bill 630, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 435. Senator Dukes, would you please come up? We do have an amendment, and you're here to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Joan Duke, State Senator from District 1. And, yes, you have a -2 amendments. If you have a -1, just ignore those. And we're working with the -2. It took us two attempts to get to what we thought the committee asked us to do when we were here in public hearing before. And what the Dash 2 amendment does is remove lines 18 and 19 and replace it with the language you have. You may remember that when we talked before, we discussed that the language in the original bill seemed a little broad, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't giving psychologists any extra authority to go out and diagnose and medical conditions, and we didn't want them setting arms and legs and things like that. And so the language that the committee actually suggested last time was is in the Dash 2s, the within the scope of the training of a psychologist, which limits what they can do a whole lot. And you will also recognize the language that was in the original bill to assess and treat medical conditions and disorders, and may recall the discussion last time about that language, that there is a difference between, clear difference apparently, between diagnosis and assessment. The diagnosis would be done by somebody else. It would not be done by the psychologist. These are folks who are diagnosed by usually an MD or DO, and they are then referred to the psychologist. And this is the amendment that we expect will limit the ability of the psychologist to go afield and try to become a doctor, which they're not interested in doing anyway, but also will allow them to treat medical conditions without having to identify and chart that person as having a mental illness. For example, fibromyalgia, something like that, if they're treating it and it's clearly a medical condition, but they're there to help try to relieve the pain, and the patient has been referred by somebody else, diagnosed and referred by somebody else, this gives the psychologist the ability to do an assessment and to work within the scope of their training, and allows them to chart something that's far more appropriate than saying this person is mentally ill because they are suffering from pain.
Yeah. Okay. Question. Senator Minnis.
Senator, is it your interpretation based on the, I'm assuming we adopt the Dash 2 amendment, that the psychologist would be able to prescribe medications?
No, absolutely not, Senator. There's nothing in this bill that indicates. The scope of their training does not include prescriptions.
All right. So you're merely saying that someone could come to a psychologist who has a problem like fibromyalgia, which is one obviously that's very hard to diagnose and treat, and some physicians, interestingly, don't even believe that exists, and they might be treated in whatever practice areas that a psychologist is currently licensed to use, or whatever methodologies they think are appropriate and the patient agrees to. Am I understanding it correctly?
You've got it exactly right. Within the scope of their training, they will be able to treat.
Why is it necessary to do this? I mean, why couldn't a psychologist already do this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, the testimony that we had before and that has come before the Pain Commission, who's sponsoring the bill, is that while the Board of Psychologist Examiners has not chosen to sanction a psychologist for treatment of medical conditions, it is not currently within their statutory purview. And so we have psychologists who are working in pain management who are very concerned that at some point in time they may indeed either they're going to keep diagnosing these people with mental illnesses or they're going to get sanctioned.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could say, every once in a while we run up against one of these things that reminds us that in this day and age, I think we understand that the body is a pretty complete entity, including the brain, and that some of our older attempts to separate what goes on in the mind with what goes on in the rest of the body just don't really fit anymore. And this bill is one of those that says you can treat both.
Okay. Are you ready? Okay. Would you make
it? Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of the Dash 2 amendment.
Okay, it's Senator Minnis moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to...
Mr. Chair, was there no further testimony on this particular bill, or was this just invited testimony?
No, this is just the work session. And I just wanted Senator Dukes to explain this is not it's not a public hearing.
We had a public hearing.
Yeah.
Well, I understand still, and I have some questions again now because there seems to be some alternate readings of this particular amendment. And I would like to hear from and have put on the record and at least explain what the other side of the issue is. Because I think what we're striving to do here was to be able to allow people to come to a psychiatrist or a psychologist, with the idea that they would not necessarily be labeled as a mental case. And there's some question as to whether this amendment, and I thought it was probably worded right, but there's some question that it still doesn't limit, as we thought it did, to a particular scope of practice, but would still allow them to basically choose any disease or any medical situation that came up.
Do you want to respond to that, Senator Dukes?
Mr. Chair, a psychologist is not trained in medical diseases.
Well, this was my reading of it, too.
Because we wrote the language, you and I, to talk about the psychologist was allowed to treat within the scope of their training, and that's what the committee suggested last time around, and that's why we went there. They're licensed to do specific things, and setting bones and doing heart surgery isn't in there, so that they would be limited to those things that are within the scope of their training, and they are overseen by a licensing board who determines what that training needs to be.
Senator Fisher, is there someone in the room that you would like to have address your concerns?
I think both the medical association and possibly the psychiatric association would be involved
good
in that.
Senator Shields, I'm sorry. You also have a question.
Well, no. It just seems so clear to me that I suppose if somebody wants to come and... I mean, this statement seems so straightforward that I didn't see a problem with it. So if there's somebody here that can make this unclear, I suppose we should give them the chance.
Well, okay. I guess my feeling is I would like to move the bill, and if there is a problem, it does have to go through the House side as well. But we've worked now on two amendments, right?
Mr. Chair, I'll work with anybody, and I have made that abundantly clear to the lobby, to all of the lobby who have expressed any interest in this bill from day one. I have made it more than abundantly clear that I will work with them to try to narrow this down so that they understand that we are not trying to allow psychologists to practice MD kind of medicine. And not one of them has taken advantage of that. I take that back. Every time we put out an amendment, I do hear from the psychiatrists. It's always in opposition, but at least I hear from them, so I will give them that.
Senator Minnis.
Sure, I'm going to ask a procedural question as to whether or not you placed my motion or not to adopt the Dash 2 amendment. I thought you had, but I wasn't sure.
We did not act upon your motion for the Dash 2 amendments.
Well, I know we haven't acted on it, but the question is whether you placed it, because if you placed it procedurally, then the discussion we're having is relevant to the motion or the adoption of the motion.
The discussion is relevant to the adoption of the motion.
So you did place the motion?
Yes.
Okay, the motion is before the committee. Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, I move that we call the question.
Okay. Would the call the question, please? To call the vote.
Senator Bennett?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Fisher? Senator Morissette.
Aye.
I'm going to vote no, and I'm going to say the reason that I'm voting no is because, again, and my understanding is that there's at least a certain potential that scope does not, of training, does not refer to the assess and treat portion of this. And that, I think, is where we have a problem.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Yes, Senator Menes.
Well, it may be appropriate now that we adopted the motion to look at those words, psychologist to assess and treat medical conditions. My understanding is the entire paragraph is connected together, and it's within the scope of practice of a psychologist. We're not adding to them their authority, the ability to do invasive procedures or to prescribe medicine or anything else. They can talk all they want about the theories and the various psychological methodologies that they may adhere to in their practice, but when it comes to prescribing medications and doing surgeries and physical examinations and so on and so forth, that's not there. And for the record, it's not there. So I don't understand, and I always love these scope of practice issues. They always get really fun, but I just don't see the argument that the... Maybe the psychologist, if you want to bring the psychiatrist up here and have them, you know,
no,
shrink our heads, then we can do that. I could probably use the psychiatrist by the time I'm done with this session, I'll tell you that much. Particularly after my tourism bill.
Do we have a motion?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move the bill to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
As amended.
Senate Bill 435 has been moved by Senator Menes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Menes?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Storm? Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
No.
Senator Morissette?
Aye. I will carry the...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, would you like to carry the...
Well, Senator Dukes is here. She's the sponsor of the bill.
I'm sorry.
Well, if he wants to be carried,
no,
it was okay
no,
with
no.
me.
No, Senator Dukes, you carry the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to give notice that if I do find that the language is loosey-goosey and creates a problem, and reserve the right to vote no on the floor. I don't think it does. I think it's clear. But, you know, they can argue me out of that position between now and it's on the Senate
and
floor.
Senator, if they do, I hope you'll work with me because
I will.
We'll be happy to try to get tighten this up. I just don't know what else to do.
Okay. I want to say that I guess this is in relation to this bill, and my reason for supporting this bill and wanting to move it is that we, you know, I don't know that this legislative body will ever reach perfection, and we spend a lot of time each session going back and tweaking things that may or may not have worked. Fortunately, in this process, we do have several bases that you have to touch. You've touched first base. Now you have to go to second base, which is in the House, and then you have to go to third base, which is, well, the governor, and then maybe you get a free walk home. I don't know. But we do have the checks and balances, and I think there comes a point where we just have to vote up or down, and if it goes, when it goes to the other side, if it goes there, then there will be an opportunity to work some more on the language. And in the worst case, or best case scenario, I should say, it will pass, and then if there is a problem, we can work on it next time. Because I think that situations change, and we just have to give it our best shot, and that's what we've done today, I think, as our best shot. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would just kind of echo Senator Menes' statement there, because I didn't have this brought to my attention until about 11 o'clock this morning, and I have not had a chance to go to anybody and actually get a legal definition of it, a what, and I had not realized that you were in such a burning urge to rid the committee of a bill. So if I can be persuaded in the meantime, I might also vote yes. So,
well, thank you.
Hopefully Senator Menes and I won't flip-flop.
Yeah. Well, I think that we've given due consideration in terms of study of the bill, and after working for two amendments, or twice on amendment, I... Okay. Thank you very much, and we will...
I have no problem staying with my vote. Please be assured of that.
Okay. So we close the work session, and we open the public hearing on Senate Bill 723. Okay, now we have two more bills. Actually, three bills to hear. I don't think we're going to pass any of them today because they all have some amendments, but if we could be relatively brief and go through and identify the problem, and then we can go back and you can work on some amendments, and we'll come back hopefully for a work session. So, Tom, if you would like to... Yes, you are here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Senate Bill 723, I'll be fairly brief if I can, addresses a fairly new problem that we've seen among the many things that people are trying to do to control drug costs is to divide in half certain medications that are, because they are priced oddly. Among the more Byzantine aspects of pharmaceutical pricing is that in some cases you may have differing strengths of the same type of medication priced exactly the same, and so there can be an incentive to split them in half. And we are beginning to see some third-party payers require that tablets be divided in half as a condition of providing coverage or providing a certain payment to the pharmacy. And while this can be a reasonable way to save money, when it is done as a blanket policy that we're going to require that all of a certain medication be split without knowing who the patients are that are involved, it's simply not safe. And I would call your attention to the third page of the handout that I passed up, which goes through some of the common issues, and I won't read all of them, but just point out a couple of them. One, patients can get confused about the directions. Are they supposed to take two halves, or are they supposed to take one half, or do they split what they have in half? They may assume that what they've got has already been split in half and take a whole when they're supposed to take a half, and so on. There are issues of whether even when a tablet is scored, sometimes you'll look at a medication, it'll have a little line across it. If when it's split in half, it will actually be a half. Studies have been run on this and shown that even when you have a very generous tolerance, that often you don't actually get a 50-50 split, and that has implications for the efficacy of the therapy. The medication itself, if it's not carefully chosen, can be compromised. And then there are issues like, has the patient got their faculties about them to be able to remember to do this? Do they have arthritis? Many seniors have arthritic conditions that make it difficult for them to do. So that's what the bill is trying to address. We have had conversations with folks in the payer community, and we have pending in legislative council another approach that we believe gets us to the same place that I believe the major stakeholders have largely agreed upon. And instead of a prohibition, as the bill does as presented, what our amendments will do, and they're outlined on the second page of my handout as we submitted them to LC, is make it clear that a payer may still, through the online billing system, send a signal to the pharmacy that we would like you to explore dividing the medication, but still leaves it ultimately up to the physician and the pharmacist to decide whether it's appropriate for that patient. And what our amendment will do is still say that if the practitioner says, no, this isn't a good idea for this patient, that would be the end of it. There would be no adverse consequence to the practitioner through the payment system or to the patient. So it will get us to where we want to go of this being available as a voluntary practice where the patients are carefully chosen and the medications are carefully chosen and not have any further expansion of what we've begun to see of sort of blanket, blind policies mandating that tablets be split. And with that, I will conclude my testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Jim Edge, would you please come up?
Good Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jim Edge. I'm the Acting Assistant Administrator for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, OMAP. Senate Bill 723 prohibits the department and its contractors from requiring a pharmacist or an individual to split a prescription medication tablet as a condition for payment or coverage of benefits. The bill also prohibits using prior authorization, differences in copayments, or other methods of influencing a pharmacist or an individual to split tablets. Many drugs are easily split at a significant cost to the department, so the department is opposed to Senate Bill 723. Currently, the department does not require that tablet splitting for medical assistance clients, but it is encouraged for suitable people for prescribed drugs that are easily split. Appropriately splitting tablets could result in considerable savings for the department. For example, one estimate suggests that our potential savings from antidepressants alone could be $2.64 million in general funds after rebates. Some of the larger managed care plans that contract with the department use tablet splitting currently to manage costs. The department does not have an estimate at this time of the savings for the managed care plans that use tablet splitting. The department does not presently use prior authorization or differences in copayments to promote tablet splitting. However, this bill will limit our future flexibility to use these incentives, if we would want to promote tablet splitting if it is needed in the future to obtain additional cost savings. Again, the department would encourage this practice only in appropriate cases, only when it is within the accepted standards of practice for pharmacy. Appropriately splitting tablets results in current savings for the managed care plans and potential future savings for the department. Senate Bill 723 may limit this practice, and for that reason the department is opposed. Thanks for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jim. What led to the idea of splitting drugs? Doesn't that seem almost self-defeating? If, you know, do they make certain drugs twice as strong as they're supposed to be, which, and then put a line down the middle, which encourages people to split them? Why don't they just make a smaller dose? It just seems to me that you may be saving money at the expense of the health of the person that is splitting the drugs for, and I don't quite understand that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as Tom Holt just mentioned, for some reason, the pharmaceutical manufacturers in their pricing structure often price a stronger tablet at the same price as a weaker tablet, and it becomes a cost-saving measure if the stronger tablet can be split rather than prescribing twice the number of the weaker tablet. And with that option available for the Oregon Health Plan and for our managed care plans, which are a large part of our delivery system, we feel that we have to take advantage of that option as long as it's available as a cost-saving measure.
Question? Yeah. Senator Minnis has a question.
I don't know if you're the right person to ask, but does anybody know if there's been an adverse reaction that someone's had or some harm that's occurred as a result of this? I know the hypotheticals and the things that were raised, but I don't know of any specific incident or someone who's actually been harmed by not splitting a pill.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Minnis, no, I'm not aware of anyone who's been harmed. The potential is there, as Mr. Holt mentioned, for someone who is elderly or disabled or doesn't have the ability to split tablets to be confused about it and to end up with the wrong dose. And we would not encourage tablet splitting in that type of a patient anyway. But it's only a potential as far as I know.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I don't know if you all are aware, but there are little devices on the market because my father-in-law was instructed to split his drug, and so you stick it in this thing and it's got a razor blade on it and it splits it right in half. They sell it on the market, so that tells me that it's pretty common practice.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, that's true. There are tablet splitting devices that are used by the organizations that are using this as a cost-saving measure, and it does allow the tablet to be split more exactly than if you were simply using a kitchen knife to do it on your counter.
Well, I guess it kind of boggles my mind that you buy a bottle of almost anything and it's filled with cotton, you have a huge bottle with a few drugs in it, a few pills or a few whatever, and here they're trying to save money by making a pill twice as strong as it's supposed to be, and they waste a lot of money on packaging and everything else. I mean, to me, it's a safety factor, and just the whole idea of splitting drugs, to me, has a bad connotation. It's just that, you know, and I know that during this time when people have been cut off from some of the life-saving drugs, they were splitting the ones that they had and had adverse effects from it. And I don't know why I'm hollering at you, Jim. You just happen to be sitting there.
That's why I'm here.
But I guess it's almost a self-defeating kind of practice to even talk about splitting drugs. You would think that they would put the, you know, they have different doses of pills and put them and package them so people don't even think about splitting them for the wrong reason. But
anyway. Mr. Chairman, I agree with you. And manufacturers do make different doses of tablets. If they would also price them so that the double strength tablet is exactly twice the price of the lower strength tablet, then there would be no need for pill splitting. But that's not the case at the present time.
And that is somewhat confusing to the consumer, I'm sure. And that's why I think it's a safety hazard to encourage people to split drugs.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I've actually forgotten that I took my medicine and took it a second time, and you know, I mean that's equally as problematic. Mm-hmm. You can't legislate, you know, somebody making it.
Well,
I mean, it's,
you can't legislate smarts or paying attention or whatever, but I think you encourage it by this whole idea of here's a little device and buy this little device and you can save half the pharmaceutical expense on whatever you buy. Well, obviously not on whatever you buy, but you know that sends a message that you split drugs. Anyway, thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Leonard Hagen and Barney. Where is Barney still? Oh, here we go. So Leonard, you go first, and Barney once again will offer us some wisdom.
And a voice.
Oh, boy. Now, keep in mind that we're going to have a, we're not going to move a bill today, so we'll try to get into the next bill before we keep it brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Leonard Hagen, Manager of Legislative Affairs for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. With me is Patty Church, Assistant Vice President of Pharmacy Services, also with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I will keep my comments very brief. Regents is a not-for-profit health insurer here in this state that represents approximately 1.2 million insureds. At this time, we do not implement or require pill splitting. However, we do believe that the practice, as you've already heard, can result in significant savings to our members at a time when healthcare costs are definitely increasing. There's a recent Mercer report that I just saw yesterday showing that Oregon is suffering more than the other states for increases in premiums. Our employer groups in the state can expect around a 15% to 18% increase. So we are interested in anything that we can do to help save costs. And for that reason, Senate Bill 723, as introduced, flatly prohibits pill splitting, and we would oppose that bill. However, we also share the concern with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association that pill splitting must be done in a manner that's safe for patients. And I appreciate Mr. Holt's willingness to work with us on the amendments. And I think that with the amendments, we accomplish both objectives, that it does preserve the ability of a health plan to implement pill splitting and realize those cost savings for members. It also requires that it can only be done within the standards of practice in pharmacy and medicine. So with that said, and with the amendments, Regents would not oppose Senate Bill 723 as amended.
Thank you.
You want to go ahead.
I only have one comment, Mr. Chairman.
I think there's...
Identify yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Patty Church. I'm pharmacy director for Regents Blue Cross of Oregon. I have one additional comment I wanted to make that I think is an important consideration. The use of split tablets allows greater variation for physicians to come up with an appropriate dose for a patient. For example, a range of doses of a particular tablet might well be from 1 milligram to 200 milligrams, and a manufacturer might make 6 or 8 strengths within that range. But the ability to split tablets, and that's very often why tablets do come already scored, allows the physician the ability to come closest to what that actual patient needs are. There may not be prepared already off-the-shelf tablets that are able to accomplish that.
Thank you for the clarification.
Mr. Chairman, again for the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. I'll be very brief. I have passed out for the for the committee's information a Oregon Drug Utilization Review Board newsletter from spring of 2001, and just point that in the in an article relating to controlling the rising cost of medications, there is, I think, some very good background information about where pill splitting can be appropriately used. And Mr. Chair, to address some of your comments very directly, which I think are very relevant to this, first of all, as this article says, and I think as Kaiser Permanente and other organizations that do use it in appropriate situations, first it has to be the appropriate kind of drug, so that if there's a small variation in the amount, because the splitting can't always be exactly equal, that variation doesn't change the therapeutic impact. Secondly, they have to be constructed in such a way to lend themselves to pill splitting. So they have to be scribed, et cetera. And then lastly, and I think the most important, is physicians and pharmacists in both cases have to feel that the patient has the competence and the willingness to be able to go on a regimen that includes drugs, pill splitting. And I just point that Table 3 on page 6 actually identifies medications, prescription medications, that lend themselves to pill splitting because of the nature of the dosage strategies and the way the pill is constructed. And from Kaiser Permanente's point of view, we actually limit on a voluntary basis pill splitting to a list of drugs that meet all of the aforementioned criteria. And I think the Dash 1 amendments that you'll get in a subsequent work session will reflect that and improves the bill.
Thank you, Barney. I'm coming to the conclusion that if Kaiser took over the whole state of Oregon, we would solve some of our problems. Do you agree with that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that that endorsement. We believe in competition.
Oh, okay.
Thank you again.
Thank you. And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 723, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 708. And will Representative Monis Anderson please come forward?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to let you know that Senator Fisher left 2 copies of written testimony that were submitted to him by fax and email for the record. Okay. One from the Riddle Pharmacy, the wellness store in Riddle, and also from Michael Hooper from the Phoenix Pharmacy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. I am Lori Monis Anderson, State Representative from District 50, which is Gresham. Senate Bill 708, I think, is extremely important, and hopefully it will move out of committee. Nurse practitioners have been independent providers in Oregon since the mid-70s, and they have had prescriptive authority, have been able to write prescriptions since 1979. And over the last 20-plus years, they have demonstrated safe, effective, and cost-effective care in both the urban and rural areas of the state. Senate Bill 708 addresses a barrier to practice that needs resolution by this legislature. So far, nurse practitioners, they need to be able to dispense drugs for some of their patients. Dispensing involves the delivery of a prescription drug in a container labeled for subsequent administration to or use by a patient. Right now, nurse practitioners can administer drugs. They can prescribe drugs, and they can dispense sample drugs, but currently they cannot dispense prescriptions to their patients. Nurse practitioners, they don't desire to become a dispensing pharmacy, but they need the authority to dispense drugs that their patients need in circumstances such as when they're participating in an indigent drug program, and those particular drugs are located in the clinic in which a nurse practitioner may be working, when their patients have no money to purchase prescriptions, and when they cannot access a pharmacy because of transportation issues. So those are three critical reasons why we would like to have this bill passed, so that nurse practitioners are able to dispense medications in their clinic. With the current economy and the number of individuals who have limited access to care, expansion of the authority of nurse practitioners to include dispensing will really help to preserve health and manage disease for many of our Oregonians. Nurse practitioners have been able to apply for emergency dispensing authority when their practice includes geography that prevents their patients from accessing a pharmacy. Those who have such authority have shown themselves to be as safe in dispensing as they are in prescribing medications that their patients need. I hope that you will move this bill.
Oh, you were going to move the bill.
I would love to move this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Susan King, Carol, John, Liz, and Ms. Evers.
No amendments.
Come forward. Four of you, and three of you can sit at the table, one behind. And we'll take your testimony, and then we have two other individuals, Tom Holt and Gary Schnabel, which we will hear before our time runs out. Yes. Susan?
Good afternoon, Senator Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Susan King, representing the Oregon Nurses Association and the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. You have my written testimony, and Representative Anderson has outlined for you some of the, we believe, compelling reasons to authorize nurse practitioners to dispense. There is one other scenario or circumstance under which nurse practitioners may currently dispense, and that is in college health centers. Those would be student health centers that exist in higher education. And those under those circumstances, we have a set of rules that describes how dispensing occurs and what provisions are required to ensure safety to the patients. In addition to the examples that Representative Anderson gave to you, there's one other scenario that occurs quite frequently, and that would be an after-hours clinic. Currently, patients whose primary provider's offices are closed have a couple of options, the most expensive of which is the arrival at an emergency department or an emergency department that has an urgent care component where they have an episodic acute illness that needs to be treated immediately. Many primary providers, and probably more, will find themselves needing to operate office hours after the usual times to allow for individuals to receive care for illnesses that are acute and need to be treated in the evening. So it's very important that a provider who's operating such after-hours clinics have the ability to dispense medications. Let me give you two examples. My clinical practice, I'm not a nurse practitioner, but I work in an emergency department, and we frequently have late evening arrivals of children and adults with reactive airway disease. It's worse at times of the year than others. And we have to teach them how to use an inhaler and then send them home with the inhaler so that they can, one, get through the night and manage the disease. So that's an example of where a nurse practitioner running an after-hours clinic in his or her office would need dispensing authority that is in addition to those scenarios already described. The last comment I'd like to make, in addition, and certainly, as I said, you have my written testimony, is we have met on a couple of occasions with Mr. Holt representing the pharmacist group, and the last meeting was yesterday. There were six areas of concern that were raised during that meeting that I'd be happy to list, but for now I'll just say that there were six areas of concern raised, and in checking with the nurse practitioner group last evening, all six areas are areas that we are willing to consider some potential language for this bill. So I do want you to know that, as Representative Anderson stated, the nurse practitioners are not interested in becoming dispensing pharmacists, but they need this authority in order to provide the care that their patients require, yet they are certainly interested in addressing the concerns of the pharmacists because their interest is the same, and that is patient safety and the appropriateness of their prescribing. Thank you.
Now my favorite nurse practitioner, Carol John, who was my attending physician for a couple of years.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. Thank you. I am, Senator Chair and Senators of the Committee, I am Carol John, and I am with the Peace Health System in Eugene. And I have practiced for 30 years, I guess, as a nurse practitioner. Or 25, I guess. I thought maybe I'd just tell you a story about how this affects me. And I'll talk about a 66-year-old lady I call Helen, who lives with her disabled son who of cerebral palsy and continues to help care for him. She has they have a combined fixed income of around $700. And she is treated for atrial fibrillation, a potential life-threatening problem with some medication that she cannot afford since she was required to retire. When she came to see me, I realized she was splitting her pills in half, and I was concerned about not having adequate medication. She was just trying to make it last longer. She applied for medication through a drug company through a prolonged system that we have in the Peace Health system, and that was going to take 4 to 6 weeks for them to respond to her. If I could sign those forms and get her drugs for her on my signature, my nurse can obtain the form through the computer. She can help the patient fill it out, and then we can fax it to the company. And then it takes a week, maybe 10 days to receive the medication. I did do this for her, but it required me to go to another area of the clinic and find a free doctor who would sign that for me and then take it back. And that set me behind about 20 minutes to see the rest of the patients for the day. So that's how that would affect me. And this is in terms of being able to supply the stock bottles from pharmaceutical companies. They're willing to supply these to patients who are indigent and able to purchase their medications. But that's considered dispensing because it's a stock bottle versus samples, which is sampling, which are a little more individually packaged.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth Ledoux. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm a women's health nurse practitioner. And I would like to talk also about the same program that Carol mentioned, because in caring for patients who are low income and uninsured, and in the clinic at the Clackamas Health Division, where I just recently retired, a large percentage of our patients have no insurance, and if they are going to get medications from the pharmacy, they're going to have to pay cash for them, and often that is absolutely prohibitive. But because the pharmaceutical companies, at least some of them, have a program whereby, as she said, you can apply, and then the patient will be allocated usually a 90-day supply of the medication, and then that can be renewed. However, the medication is not sent to the patient by the pharmaceutical company. It is sent to the prescribing provider. So it comes to you in a package from United Parcel, properly labeled bottles, which the provider then, who is a nurse practitioner, cannot hand over to the patient because that's dispensing. So in a clinic where there's a physician available, the physician might be able to come out of his room, take the package from you, hand it to the patient. But then he really should write a note. It's going to set him behind, certainly sets the nurse practitioner provider behind. And in many clinics, there is no physician, or many hours of the day, there is no physician. The clinic will be strictly operated by nurse practitioners. The only solution that we could find at the Clackamas County Clinic was for us to find a cooperating pharmacy where then one of us would carry the drugs down to that pharmacy. The pharmacist would then take the medication, relabel it for the patient, hand it to the patient, and charge the patient a dispensing fee of, I forget exactly, but I think it was somewhere between $7 and $10. So the patient, who is absolutely indigent, has no money, and the poverty of some of these patients has to be seen to be believed. Maybe $7 or $10 for one of us to pick up a prescription is probably not something that would hurt too badly, but for many of our clients it was absolutely prohibitive. That's groceries for days and days. Anyway, the cost of taking the medication down to the clinic taking it down to the pharmacy would either be borne by the clinic, or most likely was done on your own time. And then the patient had to make a trip from the clinic to the pharmacy and then pay that extra fee. So being able to allow the nurse practitioner who receives this medication in the mail to simply turn around and hand it to the patient seems to be a very simple a thing to accommodate, and it would make it much better for the patients and better for the practitioners involved.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Aaron Evers.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Aaron Evers. I'm a family nurse practitioner out of Portland, Oregon. I work at NARA Indian Health Clinic. It's a primary care clinic which serves Native Americans in the Portland area who a lot of them do not have insurance to pay for medications, and we have a small pharmacy there that a lot of the time dispense medications to them. But the problem with this is that there's not always a physician at the clinic, so we run up against hurdles of people that cannot afford the medication if we're to write out a prescription, but we're unable to give them anything other than samples that we have. So we also do not have a full-time pharmacist there to dispense the medication, and it presents quite a problem in providing the best medications for the patients. So what happens is we can either write a prescription and they could pay out of pocket, which they usually can't afford, or we pay retail price ourselves to get the medications for the patients, or we use what limited samples we may have, which are not all that extensive. So as you can see, it presents a big problem in providing the best care we can to that patient population.
Thank you. Question? Okay. Thanks. Okay, Tom Holt and Gary Schnabel. Schnabel, would you please come up?
Chair, members of the committee, once again, Tom Holt for the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I know the hour is late, but I am going to need to take a little bit of time to address this very serious issue. What's being passed out is a chart that I'm going to walk you through that explains to some degree the role the pharmacist plays in the dispensing process. The issue here is not a matter of the simple convenience of taking pills from a big bottle to a small bottle and sticking a label on it. That is one of the technical functions that takes place in a pharmacy, but that is not nearly the entirety of the dispensing process. The central role that pharmacists play is as medication experts. They have 6 years of classroom education and now an additional year of clinical rotation to be trained to go into the field to make the kind of clinical judgments that are necessary within the process. The issue here is not about turf. We are not at all concerned about nurses opening up pharmacies and dispensing pharmacies. Frankly, we doubt why anyone would want to get into such a complicated business from outside of pharmacy. So we don't really have a concern there. And it's not about the competence of nurses to perform the important roles they play in advanced practice of diagnosis and coming up with treatment plans and managing patients' care. They do that very well. It is, however, about whether advanced practice nurses are the appropriate people to oversee the dispensing of the same medications that they write prescriptions for. Now, just to go through, I'll try to go through this relative speed, but it is very important that we focus on the role that the pharmacist plays here. And I'm going to give you some examples of the kinds of things that pharmacists correct through the process.
Okay.
One, beginning with the receipt of the prescription. And on this chart, all the gray shaded boxes are areas where the pharmacist's clinical knowledge comes into play. Often, prescriptions are not clear, and that's not just a matter of messy handwriting that we've all complained about for a long time, but sometimes the dose isn't even indicated, or the dose is wildly incorrect, and the pharmacy has to make a call back and say, is this what you really meant? Did you mean 80 milligrams, or did you mean 50 milligrams? And all practitioners make these kinds of errors. It is not a knock on nurses in particular. But the pharmacy provides very important backstops to the prescribing practitioners to prevent error. So they check that prescription on intake to the pharmacy. The pharmacist has to look at that and make sure that the prescription is clear, that it's appropriate for the patient, and so on. From there, there are a couple of technical steps that the pharmacist usually is not involved in, leading up to the third-party billing process. Now, in smaller pharmacies where you have a one-person operation sometimes out in eastern Oregon, then the pharmacist is handling all of this. That system will often is the first flag, and all it is a flag for a potential problem with a prescription. It might identify, for example, duplicate therapy. It might identify that the patient has gotten another conflicting medication at another pharmacy because that information is available through the billing system. And the pharmacist then has to make clinical judgments about whether the conflict is an important one or not. For example, I was given one of many examples was given to me was two heart drugs prescribed by the same practitioner in conflict would have been a fatal interaction. The pharmacist is uniquely trained to catch that kind of a problem.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask this question. Can a physician already dispense?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menas, physicians can dispense if they have a dispensing license.
Okay.
And very few physicians have those. That is primarily, as my understanding, is done through oncology practice and some other very limited sites
but they can give
highly
out
specialized
and
products, and it's not the universe of drugs.
But they can give out samples and things like that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menas, yes, they can give out samples.
All righty. Okay, I'm lost trying to figure out what your argument is here.
The argument here, Mr. Chairman, Senator Menas, the argument here is that pharmacists perform a number of clinical judgments more often than not in the dispensing of a prescription. More often than not, if a patient is on multiple medications, there will be a problem identified. And the pharmacist has to decide whether it's an important problem.
I want to ask you this question, because it's not like you're giving me the authority to
right.
write us the prescription. They're talking about the Board of Nursing doing this, and I might have a question about the rules and just a blanket authority to do rules, but wouldn't you think the Board of Nursing would have a you know, the same issues and concerns, and deal with that in terms of their due diligence as they craft the rules with respect to how a nurse might go about doing this dispensing?
Chair Morissette, Senator Menes, we don't believe that the Board of Nursing is the appropriate place for that kind of oversight.
But they already do it.
Chair Morissette, Senator Menes, more to my point, the dispensing process, the general point I'm making here is the dispensing process is very complex, and the Board of Nursing does not necessarily have the expertise to oversee a broad dispensing authority.
But I thought that's what they said they didn't want that. I thought that's what they said.
Chair Morissette, Senator Menes, the bill does not say that. The bill says a broad dispensing authority, any drug.
No. Okay. Have you talked with the nurse group about the 6 points, the six amendments? And
Chair Morissette.
And, wait a minute. And if so, is this one of the issues that can be resolved? And if it can, then I'd like us to move on. If it can't, then you're making a point that I'm interested in hearing.
Chair Morissette, Senator Menes, we had several conversations with the Nurses Association. Yesterday was our last meeting. What I agreed to do was to take back 6 possible means to narrow the bill and ask for feedback on those. I am not a pharmacist, and I'm not qualified to make those judgments. I have to ask my board and legislative committee and practitioners for that guidance. And the answer that I got back was that none of those limitations would answer their central objections to the bills.
Okay, so there is a...
I do not believe there's prospect for compromise on these bills.
Okay, so...
Chairman,
yes.
Given that, I just assume we pass the bill out and be done with it. Because, Mr. Holt, if your organization isn't willing to go out and work the compromise, I'm not willing to sit here and listen to this discussion.
Chair Morissette, Senator Menes, in all respect, it is not a matter of being unwilling to discuss. We have a long track record in this body of discussing scope issues with other practitioners as they affect pharmacy. We've been before the health committees, for example, on nurse midwife prescribing, other prescribing practices. We worked just a couple of weeks ago with the rural health clinics on a dispensing issue, where the issue was access. And we agreed to support a bill that's coming over here from the House shortly, I believe. We are willing to work
process
when it does
hold
not.
Hold on a second. When a member's talking, you're supposed to be quiet. That's the protocol here. Do you understand the protocol?
Chair Morissette, Senator Menes, yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. But the way I work in the Judiciary Committee, which I chaired for a number of years, and I've been in this building since 1985, and if your organization is not willing to work out a compromise with this organization, then the only thing we can do is make a decision based on the merits. And I'm telling you that my decision, and I will advocate this with the rest of the committee, is to just pass the bill out and be done with it.
Okay. I thank you for saying that, because I was going to say something similar to that. And I think what we're going to have to do, I have a meeting next door at 3 o'clock, and I need to be there because I have one of my bills that are being heard. And so...
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum. I'd just assume move the bill.
Okay. Okay. So I will open the work session.
Chairman,
Senate Bill.
I move Senate Bill 708 to the floor of the Senate to do pass recommendation unamended.
Okay. Senate Bill 708 has been moved to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Would you please call the roll? Any discussion? Any other discussion?
I'm a co-sponsor on the bill, Mr. Chair.
Pardon me?
I'm a co-sponsor on the bill, Mr. Chair.
Senator Menes?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Senator
Walker?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Senator
Morissette?
Aye. The carry will be Senator Walker. Are you a co-sponsor?
I am.
Would you like to carry the bill?
I'd be delighted.
Okay. Okay, we're going to tap in. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 709. And we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 709. Thank you. And we are adjourned. Oh, boy, God, I'm...